The movie will begin in 5 moments, the mindless voice announced. All those unseated will await the next show.
Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Well, a repertory cinema is a movie house that just shows classic films, pure and simple.
It's the fun movie theater that's not like cramming the popcorn and the big buy down your throat. It's like, hey man, come back and have a good time at the movies.
That was where you went to see the classics, the cult classics, the good films.
A movie house, it's like a club that's like, you feel like it's your place when you go. It was a great place to pick up people because it was other film fanatics went there. It was a dating service, really.
There's a personality behind them, and a definite personality run by, you know, a person or a group of people that have, you know, really dedicated themselves.
A cinema that really cares about bringing back movies that people love, but also has a sort of forward-thinking idea about what a movie theater can be within a community.
It's the thrill of seeing all these movies with an audience.
There is nothing like seeing it on the big screen.
Once you're together with a bunch of different people watching a film, you're seeing it in a different way. Seeing the movie through the eyes of everyone else in the room, and you're all looking at it together. And it's a really special experience.
You go, you come out rejuvenated. You know, you never see anyone walking out of a rep house going, that sucked. You know why? Because they know exactly what they're going in there for. They've seen the movie probably a zillion times. And there's no such thing as suck. It's only going to heighten the experience.
Our cinema exists, and a lot of other cinemas like us exist, to preserve the idea that there is magic in cinema. That magic comes from an exhibition environment. That experience is so layered and rich, and you can't recreate that at home. You really can. There's just no way. Watching a movie is not an activity, it's an experience. It's something you experience. The very fact that so few are left in this world, what happens to cinema, they hold a really important place in the history of cinema. And letting them die out would be letting part of cinema die.
It's crucial that we keep repertory houses alive.
Their whole idea here is essentially valorizing and reprogramming cinema. They are, in a way, representing and re-bringing back the art in the way that it was meant to be seen.
It's kind of hard to define in a sense, I think. I think it's anything out of the norm. I hope it's anything out of the norm, because the norm is so boring.
Ultimately, I think it's whatever you make it. Basically, it's a screen and some seats and a sense of community.
So it's a place to go see old movies and to see them like they were new movies, and to enjoy them not as something from the past, but as something very new and vital.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Rob St. Mary, but I'm feeling a little inadequate tonight. Joining me as co-host, Mr. Mike White.
One of only two Mr. Whites on this show.
And also on the show this week, filmmaker Morgan White, who just completed The Rep. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. How are you?
As you can see, I'm not one of the whites right now. Maybe I should change my name, you know, sort of a... I'll take on code color last names for this little caper here. What do you think, Mr. White and Mr. White?
You could pull it off.
How about if I'm Mr. Purple? I mean, that sounds good to me. I'll be Mr. Purple.
You're not Mr. Purple. Some guy has some other job as Mr. Purple. You're Mr. Pink.
That's what I've been told. I've been known to explode in the sunlight, so I got to put that high grade sunscreen on. Anyway, this week we're talking about The Rep, independent feature documentary looking at independent movie houses. The documentary centers on the Toronto underground cinema, cobbled together in an office building by three film freaks, Alex, Charlie, and Nigel. We get to see this scrappy bunch working to build their own movie house into something they would be proud of, but at the same time, trying to get asses in seats to actually watch the cinematic delights, especially in the era of streaming video where you can get basically anything you want onto your phone. Along the way, we meet the faces behind the storied independent movie houses, large and small, all across the nation and up into Canada, including the fabled Alamo Draft House in Austin, New Beverly in L.A., the Bijou Art Cinema in Eugene, the Red Vic in San Francisco, and Blue Sunshine in Montreal, where one of our good friends from the Haunting of Julia episode, Kale Janisse, works. So on today's episode, a little bit different than we usually do it. You know, usually we have that feature grilling right there in the middle of the show with the filmmaker. Well, I thought it'd be a little more fun to put Morgan into the mix and to sort of chat about the film as we go along. So what do you say, Mr. White?
Well, it took me nearly 3 years to make, actually almost 3 years to the day, from the screening that we just had in Toronto, funnily enough, which was the Toronto premiere. And the basic inspiration came from, I was at a screening here in Toronto at the Bloor, which is talked a bit about in the film, which is one of Toronto's, I guess, better known rep cinemas, or at least it was before it was taken over by Hot Docs here in Canada. I was at a screening and I saw Alex, who's in the film and who I didn't know at the time, go barreling down an aisle with a microphone in hand. And he was flustered, as he usually is. And I turned to a friend and I said, you know, what the heck's going on? You know, this is kind of interesting because, you know, most people go to the movie theater. They don't really pay any attention to what goes on behind the scenes. They just buy their popcorn, sit down, watch the movie, or maybe watch the movie, and then go home. So I thought it'd be really interesting to kind of look at what it's like behind the scenes at a cinema, specifically an independent cinema, because ultimately I would have more access to that. And so I started doing this idea of a web series with my friends, which didn't pan out, but we decided to contact the guys at the Underground who were just opening up. And I contacted them, sat down with them, said, hey, this is what I want to do, which ultimately was a web series primarily focused on certain events and more of the lighter side of running rep cinema and also just their personalities and characters. And as I filmed for what turned out to be months and months and months, within the first month or two, I realized that there was a much greater story that was happening in front of me, mainly low attendance. Ultimately, some infighting happened. You know, just the day-to-day stresses of trying to run a cinema, which, you know, like running in the independent business is a very hard thing to do, but it's a little bit more emotional for a cinephile to be running a cinema that isn't doing particularly well. And I thought that stuff was really interesting. But I couldn't really fit it into a web series because the point of the web series wasn't about showing those realities. So I said, I guess I'll make a movie. And it wasn't a particularly conscious decision. It just kind of happened. And that's really the genesis of the film. Ultimately, the idea to expand upon it and travel around came from a couple of discussions that I had with Alex and also the other guys. Just talking about, you know, what is it like at the Alamo or what is it like at the New Beverly? Because these are cinemas that people know about, film fans know about, and film fans tend to talk about. Obviously, we all talked about it because they, to some extent, idolized the Alamo and also the New Beverly. And the question was, you know, what is it like there? And I contacted the Alamo and I said, this is what I'm doing. And I want to make a doc about, you know, the world of rep cinema and how it's, you know, hard to run a cinema. And they said, that's awesome. You should come down and interview us. So I said, oh, okay, I guess I'm going to Austin. So I contacted the New Beverly and I asked the same thing. And Mike, who runs the New Beverly, said, sure, come down. And ultimately, you know, I had two places that I was going to go. So I said, well, if I'm going to travel to these two places, I should travel to some other places. And I contacted other cinemas, and that's kind of how it all evolved. It's funny because it never really – none of this was particularly conscious. I never said, you know, I want to make a documentary about repertory cinema or I want to, you know, profile all of these different cinemas. It just kind of happened as I went along, especially through the story of the Underground, which was evolving constantly and, you know, through their ups and downs. There was a lot of story to be shown about what it really means to run a cinema.
So it sounds like it turned into kind of a almost like a tour where you're going from cinema to cinema to cinema. Is that how it kind of worked out?
this idea to expand upon it really just added depth, or at least I hope it adds depth to the film. And it was also kind of a cool thing because I had always wanted to go to the Alamo, and I had always wanted to go to the New Beverly and these other cinemas that I had heard about and talked about with friends. So it was this like cool thing where I got to go to these cinemas and film at these cinemas and meet the people that run them and kind of get, you know, a behind the scenes look at how these places operate under the best possible circumstances. Like, it's like a kind of a film geek's dream to get to go to these places and really, you know, pull back the curtain and see what they are and what they really and how they really operate. Basically, what happened was I contacted Zach Carlson, who works at the Alamo, and I said, "Hey, Zach, you know, I'm doing this thing. I'm going to come and visit you guys, and I'm also going to LA, but do you have any suggestions for other cinemas?" So he sent me a list of theaters, and I contacted all of them, and surprisingly, every single one of them said, "Sure, come on down." So I put together a schedule, and I only actually had 2 weeks off of work. It was this two-week crazy trip that I took with a friend, well, actually two friends, and we traveled all across the states, and actually, funnily enough, and almost stupidly so, I never left any like chance for failure. So there was no time for the plane being delayed, or there was no time for the car breaking down, or the gear getting sent somewhere else, or whatever. It was just, let's go and hope to God this all works. And somehow it did. And I also went to New York after a while, because Bruce took some time to actually to say yes for me to come down and interview him.
How did you get the funds to do all this? Did you do like any kind of a Kickstarter or something, or any kind of grant or something?
Most of it's out of my pocket. Yeah, it was kind of, well, this is where the whole idea of it just kind of happened comes into play. I needed lights, I bought lights. I needed a camera, I bought a camera. Like, it was never like I need funding, I just need to buy this stuff to make this movie. Ultimately, I did get some help from the company that I work for here in Toronto. I work for a distribution and production company called Tricon Films and Television, and they were very, very generous to pay for a portion of the budget. So that really actually worked out quite well. And actually, they're the reason, or that money is the reason why I actually got to go on the trip, because I could not afford to do that myself. So really, the scope of the film was heightened by the fact that I was given that money.
You took a lot of time to go to all these various places, and obviously you spent a great deal of time with the guys who were working on the Toronto Underground Cinema. When you sort of step back from it, or maybe someone who you interviewed told you this, what do you think is sort of the key to having a community that will support a rep cinema? Is it always going to be, well, we do this at a loss and we need outside funders, or can you do well in a commercial marketplace nowadays doing a rep cinema?
I think that there is no real answer to that. And it's because every community is different. Some theaters raise their funds or keep the doors open by being a not-for-profit organization. Some are lucky and can be for-profit, though that is rare. And in fact, based on a little bit of research and talking to a few people, I'm pretty sure that the only for-profit theater or repertory theater in the States is actually the New Beverly. It's or at least one of the only. It's really hard to be for-profit, and it's really hard just to show movies. So that's one other thing that a lot of these cinemas do, is they do other types of events. They put on, you know, small stage plays, maybe, or they show concerts, or they have concerts. Maybe, you know, there's all of these different ideas and different things like sing-alongs and quote-alongs and things that really add to the experience of going to the movie, because ultimately you can't create a community based on just playing movies anymore. Or at least that's the perception that I got from pretty much everyone.
I would also have to say that, you know, when you watch the rep and you meet the people who are running these rep cinemas, and specifically the guys in Toronto, you get the feeling that, much like Mike and I, probably like you and other people who are, you know, real big film fans, it's like, you know what, I'd really love to do a month of this filmmaker because he's so underappreciated and everyone should really see it. But it's like, nobody's going to come and see that. So how do they sort of balance off? Should rep cinemas be run by the money people, or should they be run by the crazy film people like us? Or is there a middle ground?
Well, I like to think that there's a middle ground. That middle ground can be seen in a place like the New Beverly or the Alamo Draft House. But those two places are very lucky in the sense that the Draft House is an enigma that just worked really, really well and became a major corporation. And the New Beverly is owned by Quentin Tarantino, so they don't have to worry about paying for rent. I don't know. See, there's like the film buff in me that wants to say that these places should be run by film nuts that want to play crazy movies and you know, really add to the cinematic enlightening of their communities. But it's a business, and it's really hard to do that. And in fact, it's almost impossible to do that. You can't do a week of, I don't know, De Palma movies because no one's going to come to all of them. They'll come see Carrie and maybe Scarface, but that's about it. It's really, really difficult to find a middle ground. And that's why you also see a lot of repertory cinemas playing the same films or independent cinemas playing the same movies. Or you'll see them doing things like playing second run content. That's a big thing for independent theaters to make money because maybe somebody didn't want to go see whatever the latest blockbuster was at the multiplex and pay $15 or however much it costs now, depending on where you are, and are content with paying $7 or $8, which is generally the price of going to one of these cinemas. There has to be something else, and you can't just do whatever you want, basically.
It seems like a lot of them kind of will use their schedule to also show new independent films or new art house films, things that, you know, the older generation is probably clamoring for, or our generation. You know, there are different things that are coming out where it's just like, oh, hey, yeah, you know, I really want to see this art house film and there's no place to see it. So you can see it pretty new at one of these rep cinemas, and then maybe on the weekend they will do like an older film or a midnight show, that kind of stuff. It seems like that's a good way to find that balance as well.
No, definitely. And I think that art house films are a big thing, and also independent films. Independent cinemas are a great place for indie filmmakers to get their film out there. It's really hard to make a movie and get people to see it, especially in a theater. So an independent cinema can utilize their ability to screen other types of films or independent films and you know, benefit the filmmakers and also potentially benefit themselves by, you know, hopefully making money from them.
One of the things that I liked in there, in speaking about seeing a film on film, is that one of the guys that you follow in Toronto, big buff of, like, you know, you got to see it on a print, 35 millimeter. And I just did a story recently for my day job about a theater that has basically been told through the studios that if they don't convert to digital soon and figure a way to do that at the cost of anywhere up to $100,000, that pretty much they're going to be out in the cold, that the studios are no longer sending film prints. And I was wondering, you know, that obviously is a huge cost for a mom and pop, small, you know, couple, maybe you got three screens or even just one. How do you see that as another hurdle for rep cinemas, this digital conversion?
Well, see, that's kind of the insurmountable hurdle for most of these theaters right now. It's about $100,000 to $150,000 to put in what is known as a 2K projector, which is only half the resolution of film, supposedly. I don't believe in this whole digital resolution matching up to what film is, but that's just my own thing. So it's really, really expensive, and it's almost impossible for a lot of these cinemas to pay that amount of money. Ultimately, the way that it was supposed to work was that the studios were going to fund all of these projectors, but that didn't wind up happening. It's interesting, and it makes sense as to why the digital conversions are happening. Just out of curiosity, how much money do you both think the studios save every single year by not shipping prints and shipping hard drives instead?
Oh, I can't even imagine how much, just with the shipping cost alone, how much it would be. I mean, just the weight of a drive versus those cans, because those cans are freaking heavy, man.
I remember when I was making my first film in 16 millimeter, and I know that a full print in 35 was probably north of $4,000. And when you consider that, at most, the highest hard drive that you can find, and I'm sure they're going to buy them in bulk, is probably a couple of hundred bucks. So if you look at just the cost differential between a hard drive versus a film print, you're talking, you know, it's probably 10%. That's what it costs of what it would cost to be a film print.
Ultimately, the studio saved $1 billion a year, which is a crazy number to think of. The fact that, you know, they can push for the digital projectors and digital cinema, and they save $1 billion a year. So it makes sense, but it's affecting all of these cinemas, and that's the thing that I don't think that they completely understand. Because ultimately, the mom and the pop movie theaters don't really mean that much to them because they're playing older content or they're playing indie fare, which makes up a small percentage of their ultimate gain. They really care about the multiplexes, and that's why they subsidize the installation of projectors into multiplexes. But for some reason, they're not doing it for the small mom and pop shops, even though at one point that was the intention. And I'm not sure where along the lines that changed, but it did. And now these theaters are being forced, and they're being forced right now. Like, there are theaters across North America that are being told, if you don't convert by the end of the year, we're not going to be giving you anything. You won't be able to get film prints. You won't be able to get old films on print. Nothing. No more film. Only digital. Which, you know, for the theaters that convert is great because they have access to films again, and they're fine, and they don't have to worry. And in fact, they're the ones that are going to weather the storm. But the people that can't convert will ultimately have a very, very big decision to make, whether they continue on or whether they close. They figure that, you know, about 1,000 theaters across North America will close ultimately, which is a lot of screens because those are primarily single screen theaters. So that's a lot of theaters that are just going to disappear.
Do you think there's any way that there's enough collectors that are out there that are willing to rent out prints that somebody could still continue going on with a 35mm system and just rent from different collectors and have some sort of a pool out there of, you know, different films? Or do you think that kind of would dry up pretty darn quick?
No, I think that is actually a possibility, and that is happening to some extent. I'm on a couple of message boards that are for film collectors because I actually myself collect 35mm prints. So there are prints, and in fact, there are prints out there that no one even knows exists. Like, things that the studios don't even know that people have, or things that maybe the studios don't even have themselves, are actually out in the world. So it is possible for someone to, you know, just do that. But think about it in this sense. If you want to do that, it's going to cost you however much it costs to ship a print. So that's, you know, $100 to maybe $200 or $300, depending on where you are. If you have to cross a border, like up here in Canada, it became very expensive sometimes to rent a print from the States because it would cost way more to ship it across the border. So there's all of those factors. And also, a lot of collectors either want a rental fee or they won't talk to you if they don't trust you, because it's still kind of a black market thing. It's still kind of underground. It's becoming more open, and a lot more collectors are more content with talking about the fact that they have films. But ultimately, those prints are, in fact, the property of the studios. So it is kind of technically illegal to own them. Just a thing that I don't think they really care about anymore, so no one's particularly worried about it. I think there's hope, and there's hope for people like in the film, Ed, who works at the Bijou in Eugene. You know, he has a ton of prints, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of collectors out there who have that much stuff or more. So hopefully that is a way for people to keep going.
Yeah, I guess, too, you have to worry about if you're renting something to a, you know, some Yahoo somewhere that's going to screw up the print and not know how to project it right, you know, scratch it up and chop it up and all that kind of stuff, too. So I can imagine some of these guys are pretty tight when it comes to what they loan out to who.
I'm sure you collect DVDs and Blu-rays and all that stuff. You're probably fairly picky about who you lend that stuff to. Right? You're a film fan. I'm the same way. You want to lend a print to somebody, prints can cost thousands of dollars if you find the right one. So ultimately, it's a really big risk to lend that out. So I think that there's all of that aspect to it as well. You have to kind of, you know, build a relationship with the collector, show that you know what you're doing, show that you have a theater, show that you're a good projectionist, or you have a good projectionist working for you. It's a whole different thing. And I know a lot of collectors are just hardcore film nerds. and they're not particularly the most sharing people in the world.
So let's talk a little bit more about the film, if that's all right. Let's talk about the way that you've got it structured in here and just the way that this kind of unfolds. I like that, you know, even though you weren't doing a web series, that the film is very episodic, that you have these kind of nice chapter marks, you know, and we follow the main characters, our three guys from the Toronto Underground, as they kind of struggle through things. And then you take little breaks and take us almost on a tour of where other things are. You know, you talk about the Red Vic closing in San Francisco, or you talk to the, you know, different film collectors or different rep houses as we go along the way. And just the way that the story unfolds, I think, is very nice, and it kind of reflects that organic way that this documentary seemed to come about.
There were very, you know, definable moments that I wanted to capture throughout the course of the ultimately the year that I followed them for, at least the year that I present within the film. And I wanted to structure it that way, but there were also different things, like key things that I wanted to hit upon. So I wanted to talk about 35 millimeter because that's a big thing for Alex. So that was a section that I tried to create. And there was all the stuff of, you know, the infighting. So that was its own thing, you know, and then there's the event, which culminated at the Underground with the Adam West event. So then there was the idea of going out and looking at what other people do for events. I guess I never really thought of it in an episodic format, or at least looking at it in an episodic way. But I definitely see the way that the film is structured that way. I don't know if the episodic idea was particularly conscious. I tried to find a film where, you know, things would happen at the Underground and then there would be some sort of external explanation for all of that, or at least a look at what happens in other cinemas, whether it be contrary or the same across the board. I wanted to use the Underground as like a jumping off point to talk about the world of repertory cinema, or at least the world of independent theaters.
When you got in, you started following these guys around. How did it kind of work for you? I mean, I know how it is as someone who's done documentaries before, and also my day job as a reporter, where, you know, at times you're like, well, this person's interesting, that person's not, or maybe you might not even like someone all that much, or you got to deal with their craziness. How did you find it working with the three guys in the Toronto Underground?
Each of them have their very distinct personalities that were both easy to work with, difficult to work with at different times. And each one of them, you know, took different amounts of time for them to be comfortable with me being there. But I kind of just filmed. I didn't really care so much about what they were thinking about the fact that I was there filming. I just left the camera rolling and hoped for the best. And generally that worked out, but what that created was this sense of, oh, there's Morgan, he has a camera, whatever. And they stopped really noticing and even caring about it. And then that made it easier for me to just kind of become a part of the theater. And that's really what happened, was that I became a part of the Underground. I wasn't necessarily working at the Underground or really taking part in any of the programming or planning or anything, but I was there so much that they just became very comfortable with me. So I was like the fourth guy that was at the Underground. And ultimately, people who were regulars at the Underground also became very comfortable with me, knowing that I would be there, and it didn't really bother them. Dealing with their personalities was fine because, you know, I kind of saw myself in each one of them in different ways, so I kind of tried to tap into that as much as possible. I think that, you know, asking a question once and then not necessarily getting the answer that I wanted, but asking it 2 weeks later, again, under different circumstances, led to the ability to get the things I wanted from them. You know, sometimes when you're interviewing somebody, they don't always give you exactly what you want. You have to figure out a way to get that. And the beauty of what I was doing was that I spent so much time with them and I was there for so long that I didn't have to worry necessarily about not getting something, because I could get it later and kind of piece it all together.
When you were putting it together, sort of filtering it through your head, you know, obviously as a film fan and other movies that you had seen, what would you say were sort of maybe influences on you, maybe other films or documentarians that you were like, you know, I really like the way so-and-so handles a style, and maybe that's where we should go with this?
I tried not to get too, you know, marred in that, because you can get really stuck thinking of how you would think another filmmaker would make something. Ultimately, I'm a big film fan, and I really love documentaries, or I always have really loved documentaries. So, you know, people like Herzog, I love the way he makes his documentaries. I also really love Errol Morris. I love the way that Errol Morris does interviews and how they feel very natural. Ultimately, I didn't do the, you know, look straight at the camera thing that he does, but I tried to create some sort of naturalism within the interviews. So maybe I was thinking Errol Morris when I was doing those. I don't know. Also, I come from the company that I work for is a reality TV company or a lifestyle television company. So I'm constantly in that world of lifestyle television. Now, I'm not saying that I used lifestyle television as a basis for creating this film, but I'm sure that to some extent that idea, or at least the stuff that I had always seen people doing at work, probably flowed into the way that I made things too. I just tried to find the best way to tell the story. And I know that, like, there's two different styles kind of floating within the film, in the sense that, you know, there's like a cinema verite style, which is just me following them around. And then there's also a very, you know, structured interview style, clashing almost, but I don't know if it was like a conscious decision to do that. It just made sense for me to do it that way.
Yeah, you captured some really uncomfortable moments, and I really appreciate that. You know, we get to see these guys kind of warts and all.
I always wanted to do that, and I always found it interesting. Like, they had very distinct personalities, and sometimes they clashed, and sometimes they worked really well together. So I always went into it with the idea that I was going to show them for who they really were. And I was always very upfront with that, with them. I would say things like, you're all going to look bad, but you're all going to look good, because that's life. We all look bad at certain points in our lives, and we all look good at certain points in our lives. So I kind of wanted to create that. And also, I think that whole ability to show some of the harder things, or the sadder things, came out of the fact that I was there so much that they forgot that I was filming, or they knew that I was filming, but they didn't think about it so much. It was just a normal thing for me to be there, because I was basically there from the day they opened right until the day they closed. And so they got really used to me being there. And they just opened up because of that. And we also all became friends, so they trusted me in that sense. At least I hope they did.
Was there ever any kind of awkwardness as far as you being their friend, but also trying to capture all this stuff and, you know, letting them know that they might not turn out in the best of light?
I don't know. I don't think so. At least not from my perspective. You'd have to ask them exactly how they felt about it. But from my perspective, I'm the kind of person, like, I can not become friends with somebody that I'm with that much, right? It would be impossible for me to stay completely outside of that world, or at least outside of them as people. So I kind of just became friends with them. So I think that helped in them opening up.
There are times where they seem like really kind of naive, like when they're talking at the beginning, they sold out their first screening, and that's kind of a natch because you've got the buzz and everything. And then when attendance drops, like almost the first week that they're open, it's like, yeah, of course it's going to drop. And it just felt like, you know, come on, guys, get your head out of your ass. Of course, you know, attendance isn't going to be like this every single night.
Ultimately, they went in with that gung-ho spirit, and they kind of kept going with that as long as they possibly could. They all had different forms of experience, except for Charlie, who had never worked before. So he had no real experience other than being a film fan. Alex and Nigel had both worked at cinemas. They had some sort of experience, but none of them really knew how to run a theater or even run a business from the ground up. They just went into it with this, you know, doughy-eyed, we're going to make this work no matter what, confidence. And that, you know, obviously didn't work out perfectly for them in all respects. I always kind of liked that about them, though. There was some sort of, like, charm to the fact that things are shitty right now, but they're not always going to be shitty. And, you know, like, yeah, okay, so we're not having a ton of people showing up, and it's really hard, and we're really, like, you know, down because of that. But there was still this, like, naivete to the whole thing that was almost kind of inspirational, because they were trying so hard to do this, and they cared so much about it that you wanted to see them succeed no matter what was happening.
I think it was good, too, the way that you have two fairly major things going on as far as the, let's call it the Adam West incident or the Adam West screening, you know, which seemed like it was very much a success, even though it might have ultimately been a little bit of a failure as far as the amount of cash they had to outlay to Adam West with the whole Batman screening. And then you've got the whole Canadian Cinema Week thing. That one is a little bit, I won't say it's not fleshed out, but can you tell us a little bit more about that whole Canadian Cinema Week? Because it just seems like such a disastrous time for them.
Well, it was a disastrous time. Alex had this idea that he wanted to do this showcase of Canadian films. So they used social media as a way to ask people what they wanted to see. So it was a way of connecting directly to the audience that they thought they had, and ultimately found out that they didn't. I think it was this idea that, you know, Alex had a theater. He really wanted to do this thing that he truly, truly believed in, and he was going to do it no matter what. And ultimately, it failed. Failed for multiple reasons. One, Canadian films by their nature in Canada are not particularly well respected. It's just this stupid thing that we all have in Canada where we don't like Canadian films and we all think they're of a less quality. It makes absolutely no sense. It's just a thing that we all think for some stupid reason. A lot of the Canadian films that they were playing were things that people had already seen many times because they were the popular Canadian films, if you will. And also, social media is by no means a way for anyone to gauge attendance or even interest, because it's really simple for someone to say, you know, I really do want to go and see that. Or, yeah, no, we should, you guys should play this film. But when the night comes, they're not going to get up off their ass and go and watch it. They're going to stay at home and think, well, I watch the DVD, or, you know, ultimately I just don't really care about going out. And I think that that was part of the downfall, is they put a lot of pressure on the idea of social media showing them what people wanted to play, but it didn't really matter because social media is not a way to do that.
Right. And then it also seemed like they were having problems getting prints and everything at that point.
Yeah, well, they were having problems getting prints at that point, mainly because there weren't as many prints, for one thing, but they also owed money to the distributors because they couldn't always pay their bills. And that was just the fact that they didn't have a constant stream of patronage to be able to justify the cost of a lot of these films. So there was back payments owed on their with their distributors, and so it made it difficult for them to get some of the prints. And ultimately, as you see in the film, one of the prints didn't show up, and they had the DVD, and that was disastrous. Twofold, because the DVD skipped, and ultimately the DVD, like a DVD, is not an exhibition format and should never be assumed as an exhibition format or used as an exhibition format, but it was all that they had. And that was just a financial thing. It was a financial thing that was affecting the underground, but it is a financial thing that I think affects a lot of cinemas. It is hard to, you know, sometimes pay the bills or at least keep completely up to date. I think a lot of cinemas do fine with that, but it's difficult because it costs a lot of money to put on a movie. It can cost hundreds of dollars to put on a movie, which is something I don't think most people realize. You have to pay what's called a minimum. And if you're back, you know, if you owe money on your minimums or you don't have the money for a minimum, then they don't release the prints and you can't buy it.
Well, also, I think part of it is that most people don't know the economics of a theater anyway. They believe that when you go and you put your $7 or $10 down to get your ticket, that the folks behind the counter there are getting that money. And usually with these percentage deals with a lot of distributors and especially the studios, that's why the popcorn costs $4, is because that's where they actually make the money.
Exactly. All of the money from any theater comes from the snack bar. That's a common thing that happens at the multiplexes just as much as it happens at the indie theaters. There's a percentage that every film costs every theater to play. It's a little bit less for a rep film. It's more for a new film. But ultimately, when you pay your ticket price, not all of that money is going to the theater. In fact, a very small percentage of that money is going to the theater. So the films, by their nature, already are outpriced. Like you have to hope for a certain amount of people to even pay off the fact that you've rented this print, and that's really hard to do in some instances because, you know, maybe two people show up. And if two people show up, you certainly did not make the money for that print or for that film at all to be able to play it.
So I feel I have to do like a little full disclosure kind of thing, that it was funny watching this documentary and seeing this whole Canadian cinema thing happen. And you had a date on there of December 2nd, 2010. And I was actually at the theater, I think it was the 11th of December 2010 for a book promotion event. So it was really funny to see like where I was in the history of, you know, the Toronto Underground. You know, I have met these guys. I haven't necessarily, you know, hung out with them or anything because they were all like completely busy that night. But I just kind of wanted to, you know, let folks know that there is this connection kind of thing. So I'm not, you know, trying to put anybody down or anything when I'm talking about, you know, their business, because, you know, they helped me out doing this event and everything. So.
Well, I think ultimately the one thing about the Underground that they were really good at was they really cared. And they showed everyone that came in there that they really cared, especially rentals, like people that would rent the place or would come in and do an event. They worked their asses off to make sure that those events or those rentals went as well as possible. And they really cared to make sure that they were inviting people into what they considered to be their home and showing, you know, them as much love as they possibly could. Do you remember me being there just out of curiosity? Because I remember when you came.
I remember you, yeah. I don't remember a whole lot else about that evening because I was just so frenzied about stuff. And I think I ended up showing up later than I wanted to and then was worried about the projection and everything. We ended up showing off of like a beta deck that John Pace had brought over, and because we were showing Crime Wave and everything. And I was like really concerned about him and making sure that, you know, he was being treated right and everything. So I was just in a flurry myself.
Well, I remember that night. I remember setting up that beta deck. I started doing that stuff because I'm really technically inclined. So when there was like a deck that needed to be set up, I was the one that did it because I do it at work. So it was just like, there's a beta deck. I don't know how to set this up. Here, Morgan, set it up. That was kind of like my job.
Well, I appreciate you doing that because it ended up looking great. So that was terrific.
You're welcome. I wasn't really looking for a thank you, but... I'm glad that I could help.
The theater seemed to close down. What was it like? It seemed like in like May of 2011, they kind of had a little dead cat bounce where things started to look okay. And then they closed down what shortly thereafter. And I know that the Toronto Lightbox has been open since roughly around that same time. Do you think that the Lightbox has done damage to the rep cinema scene in Toronto?
Yes. It's really tough to say exactly how much damage they've done, or in fact, if they have done any damage. But my assessment of it is that, yes, they have. Every cinema plays off of every other cinema, especially an independent cinema, because everyone paying attention to what everyone's doing. That was definitely a problem. Also, there's something in Toronto works based on zones. So there is specific zones where things can be played in. If one theater in one zone has a film, then another theater can't play that same film at the same time. That doesn't always mean reps, screenings, but it does to some extent. So I think that, you know, when the Lightbox happened, and then there's the Scotiabank, which is a big multiplex in that same area, and then there's also the AMC, which existed. It's now a Cineplex as well. It was an AMC at the time. It's in the same area. There were all of these competing theaters in the same area, and they were all kind of affecting each other, but primarily two multiplexes, and the Lightbox were really affecting the Underground, making it impossible for them to get certain films. Primarily Second Run, which would have really helped them had they been able to play things that had just the multiplex. But the multiplexes were keeping those films longer and they weren't allowing them out. I do think that the Lightbox affects things in the sense that they have government funding, so they can do things like promote. It's very, very, very expensive to promote a screening or market a screening. The Lightbox can do that. The Underground or any other independent cinema has a much harder time doing that. You can put up flyers and pamphlets and all that kind of stuff, and that's fine, but that doesn't necessarily attract people like what the Lightbox can do with the posters or the fact that they have great street presence or people talk about them. That's another thing. The Lightbox has like engendered this faction of people that are quite adamant about going there, and that really helps that too. And I also think to some extent the Lightbox plays things that the other reps play, but has the ability to market them so more people go to it there. That's definitely a problem. It's really tough to say, and it's also really hard for me to make a clear judgment on that because I'm slightly jaded in the sense that I was a part of the underground. I was there for a long time. I saw it directly through their eyes. So it's hard for me to take like an external look at it completely, but I will say that definitely every theater affects every other theater to some extent.
Well, as kind of an outsider, as a Detroiter looking up at our sister over to the east there, it seems to me like the Lightbox is kind of this, you know, 800-pound gorilla that just like, you know, not only can they show 2001 A Space Odyssey, but they can show it in 70mm. Not only can they show it in 70mm, but they can get Donald Trumbull out there to talk about the special effects. You know, it's like anything that a rep cinema wants to do, they're going to do it 100 times better. And yeah, they've got all the funding in the world, it seems like, and just having the whole Toronto Film Festival behind it feels like, you know, they're swinging, you know, with both hands carrying axes and just lopping the heads off of any kind of smaller cinema that wants to quote unquote compete with them.
No, I completely agree. That is exactly how it is. I mean, they won't say that that's the fact. And I think a lot of the rep cinemas also won't say that that's what's happening, but I think that ultimately is what's happening. They have money. They can do a lot more. They can bring in a lot more people and they can bring in a lot rarer things. Lightbox being an archive can actually access prints that no one else can access. So sometimes they play things that no one else can touch. That makes it easier for them and makes it easier for a film fan to say, well, I'm going to go to Lightbox and see that because I know that Brent's big new theater and the projection equipment is really top shape and they have the best projectionists and they get access to the best prints. And there's all of those factors that come into play that a repertory cinema or an independent cinema in Toronto or really anywhere else that deals with Cinematheque has to struggle with. Like, it's really difficult for an independent cinema to access certain things. And it's also, you know, like they don't necessarily have the best projection or the best equipment because it's expensive to keep all that up all the time. So maybe it goes an extra couple of months without getting, you know, fine-tuned. But the Lightbox sure as hell has the money to do that. And you know that they're fixing everything properly.
Yeah, you're not going to see a pink print up there, I'm sure.
Oh, well, I've seen pink prints of, like, Grindhouse movies that they've played, but you won't see them, like, you won't see a pink print of, like, some 70s classic film. They'll go and get a restoration print, or, much to my dismay and, in fact, disgust, they'll play a digital print when they clearly have access to a perfectly fine 35mm version of that. I saw they played Apocalypse Now Redux. And they brought in Walter Murch one time, and I go, well, that's amazing. I'm going to go to that because I love Walter Murch, and I love hearing him talk about editing, especially something like Apocalypse Now, which he was so, you know, big on with editing and also with the music. I went, and they played a digital print, but I had seen maybe 2 years prior to that a very, very good-looking 35mm print that they could have played. Like, there was no reason not to. And to me, the Lightbox and all Cinematheques exist for that reason, to play films on film because they can, unlike some other places that can't.
I don't know if it's just the difference between Canada and America, but, you know, I look around, I look at like New York and Chicago, and Chicago's got the Siskel Center. So, of course, they've got a little bit of money behind them and everything, but there are still so many viable repertory cinemas in the city that they're not competing with each other when something comes along that might have a little cachet to it. You know, you can still go to the Music Box and still go to some of these other smaller micro cinemas and not have to worry about that. But yeah, it seems like the government really, you know, it's great that government film funds arts. That's terrific. But I guess it's kind of a double-edged sword at times.
It seems to be that way. The question is, how long is that going to last?
Yeah, is it going to be like one of these things where they come in, drive all the smaller ones out of business, and then they kind of, you know, put the brakes on how great they are? You know, it's that whole like, you know, we'll be the next hot flavor, you know, we'll be the next blockbuster, drive the mom and pops out of business, and then we'll fold to Netflix or whatever it is.
Ultimately, to me, I think the best way to look at the Lightbox or even any other Cinematheque who's kind of outside of the repertory world, they're kind of like the studios looking at the mom-and-pop theaters. The mom-and-pop theaters don't really mean anything to them at all. They're irrelevant. So I think they would probably say well, we're not stealing programming from them, or we're not doing anything to affect them. They are. They're just not paying attention to the fact that they are, because they don't ultimately think that much about them. So it's like the studios with digital. They're not thinking of the independents or the small cinemas, because they're thinking about the multiplexes. And that's what the cinema techs are doing. They're thinking about their big, massive theaters and all of the cool stuff that they get to do, and they're not really thinking about what an independent cinema really has to deal with.
All right, so let's go ahead and we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more of Morgan White and the Rep on the Projection Booth.
You know, I was looking for a little excitement, but I was worried about privacy. And then I found out about Vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women, and men, and couples. They have helpful suggestions and information on how to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has never played around with your privacy. While other .coms make their money by selling your information, Vibrators.com never has, and never will. And when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order. That's Vibrators.com. Get a little excitement in your life.
Hi, this is Kevin Batchelder. And this is the Saturday B-Movie Reel.
Newsom, shoot it! Shoot it!
That about describes it, yeah.
All right, everybody stay here.
We look specifically at the Sci-Fi Channel's original movies. You know the ones that air on Saturday night.
Be known throughout the ages as an instant classic.
We need a bigger gator!
Limb cutting, yes. And blood squirting from...
Flying limbs, I called it in my notes.
What could go wrong?
We look on a regular basis at the movies as they come out, and since there have been over 200 of them, we do go back and look at many of them that are now out on DVD. By this point, I had completely forgotten any semblance of seeing if this actually makes any sense from a plot point of view. So come on by, get involved, and have some fun.
Check us out at SaturdayBMovieReel.com.
Our future depends on it. Make it safe.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
We're back. We're talking about The Rep with filmmaker Morgan White up in the Great White North of Toronto. So when it comes to the film, you know, it's been out there a little bit. We got a chance to see it. It's played a few festivals. What's the reaction been?
The reaction has actually been quite good. What I tried to do with the film was kind of create some sort of like a film fans unite type of film. And that seems to be the reaction that it's getting, which is really awesome. I've, you know, gotten emails from people who've seen it, or I've gotten Facebook messages from people who said, you know, I did not realize that this is what it actually means to run a theater. I'm going to go and support my local theater more. And that's really cool. And also what I've been doing with the film, I've been offering it to any independent cinema for free, and they get to keep 100% of the profits and put it back into their theater. It's my small way of giving back to these theaters that matter a lot to me. But it's really kind of opened up this dialogue, which is really great. So I'll contact the theater and I'll talk to them about potentially screening it. And then they'll say yes or no, but mostly they say yes. And then they say, you know, this is really great. This is a way for me to show my community what it really means for me to run this theater. So it's been really interesting in the sense that, you know, I'm even getting this thing screened at theaters that primarily screen first-run content in their small towns, where they're also struggling to get people to come out, because sometimes people would rather drive, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 miles to a multiplex to see something. They're not going to their independent, their small cinemas in their towns. So it's kind of created this like dialogue. I mean, I couldn't be happier with that's why I made it, and it seems to be working, and I'm forever thankful for that fact that people are taking away what I wanted them to take away from it. I don't know if I, you know, this is going to sound like I didn't know what I was doing, but this is my first movie, so I didn't know if I had put all of that stuff into it, and it seems that people are taking that stuff away from it, so I think I've succeeded at least in that part.
What do you have next for the rep throughout the summer, fall, and throughout the end of the year?
There's a whole bunch more screenings that are happening. There's a few in other countries that are coming up, which is really cool. There's one in England playing at the Prince Charles in London. The Prince Charles being a quite a famous repertory cinema, one that Tarantino loves and goes to a lot. That's a big thing for me. It's just really cool to like have it screen at a place that Tarantino likes. Whatever. That's just me being a film geek. It's playing in Australia, which is really cool. It's going to, you know, play across North America. And I've signed a deal for digital distribution, which hasn't been formally announced. And I'm not entirely sure all of the details of what format it's going to come out on first, but it will show up in iTunes at some point. And it will show up in Netflix. While we all understand that that is kind of ironic that it's showing up on those platforms, it's really nice that, you know, eventually people will get to see it. And that should happen sometime in the fall.
As for, I mean, you talked about the audience reaction. You talked about some of the screenings that are coming up. How have the critics been? As if the critics matter, like us. But how have the critics been?
You take that stuff with a grain of salt. critics have actually been quite good. Generally, the reviews are quite positive. I mean, there's always a few that aren't particularly great or, you know, but ultimately everyone tends to get the message of the film, whether they like the movie or not. So that's great. But at least the message comes across, whether they enjoy the story. I mean, it's part of making a film, right? You make something and you hope that everyone likes it, but ultimately not everyone's going to like it. And that's just part of it. Film is subjective. And that's kind of the beauty of film, is that everyone has their own opinion of what they like and what they don't like. And I kind of actually dig that because I'm very opinionated when it comes to film. So it's kind of interesting to hear other people being opinionated about my movie. It's humbling to some extent. And it also makes me think about what I'm going to do next, or at least how I'm going to do my next project.
So what is the next project that you have on the horizon? You got anything else, or are you just so worried about this one that you're going to spend all your energy on that?
Well, I mean, I'm really busy. This has kind of become a second job again. It wasn't for a while, but it's come back in the sense that, you know, getting it out to cinemas and contacting cinemas and talking to cinemas and sending packages out, all that kind of stuff. Because ultimately, I'm doing all of this myself. So it really, that's taken up a lot of my time. I have some other ideas that I'd like to do, potentially another documentary, but none of that's really concrete at the moment. So I haven't really started on anything, but I do want to make more movies because this has been a phenomenal experience doing this thing. And I'm, you know, forever grateful that I was afforded the opportunity to do it, because I always grew up with this idea that I wanted to make movies, never thinking that, you know, we all kind of grew up with this idea of wanting to make movies, and not everybody gets to do that. So I'm really thankful that I got the opportunity. And you know what? I guess if this is the only thing I make, then I'm really happy and proud that this was made and that people are reacting to it.
So we're going to take another break and play a preview for next week's show.
When video cassettes first came in, we jumped in. We loved it. We thought it was great. There were video stores opening up all over the world that needed movies.
You could all of a sudden be introduced to all of this stuff that never would have been available, never would have shown on TV, never would have been in your movie theater.
Production price tag, you know, Terminator, $80 million, Puppet Master, $400,000. Not an even playing field, but on the video store, they were all on the same shelf, they were all in the same size boxes.
They've made it so simple to use, the cat can operate it. Kittles? We were the first generation that could be sent to bed with a promise, it'll be here tomorrow when you get up.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.